I hope you all had a good lunch and that you're not going to sleep
after your lunch. I'm just going to talk about, because I've been employed recently by Saudi Arabian Airlines, and I just want to make some publicity for them. And if you don't mind, and I've given up the study of pyramids, it's all over. Nah. There is something in this picture that will demonstrate to you a rather strange phenomena. Like Robert was saying, I mean, it's one of those strange things that these fissures, these cuts made by water, were always there. They had been there for thousands of years. They had been seen by millions of people visiting Egypt. They had been seen by Napoleon, they had been seen by... nobody noticed them. They were there, but nobody noticed them. It took Robert shock to come and say, wait a minute, these things are vertical, and he developed all his geological theory. There is something in this picture that nobody had noticed, except one person noticed, and here is the story very briefly, I'll move quickly. The king of Saudi Arabia in 1981, I happened to be in Saudi Arabia at the time, was going to board the royal flight this, with a similar plane like this, and suddenly a priest, they call him Mutawaz, you know, the guy walks with a beard and he has the Quran, and, said, stop, you can't go on this plane because it has on it the Christian cross. Now, you may or may not know this, but Christian or Jewish or any other religion in Saudi Arabia is not allowed. You're not allowed to display icons and crosses, especially. So they all froze and said, where is it? I mean, how is this man seeing the Christian cross on the plane? And surprisingly, once you realize it, is there a pointer here? There a pointer? The stick. Oh, I feel like a school teacher. Come here, you. Here it is. And the problem is, once you see it, you will always see it. Really. And then, my God, it was not just on the planes, it was on the tickets, it was on the shops, it was on the plastic cups, it was everywhere. Saudi Arabia was flooded with crosses. And the king said, we can't have this. And what they did is they actually changed it to this. They removed just one arm, and that was it. But the point I'm making is that it's one of those strange things that it was there for everybody to see, and nobody saw it. The fissures were there for everybody to see. Nobody saw them. Well, I saw something that, amazingly, nobody had seen before, and I'll tell you the story, because it leads us to some rather extraordinary conclusions. I'll tell you the conclusion now, so you'll see where I'm leading. I have come to the conclusion that the Giza pyramids, the Giza complex, the pyramids and the Sphinx, is representing something. It is some kind of message. It is, and strangely, this message is conveyed in a manner that can be understood by us, by anybody, on this earth, or elsewhere. And the reason being, as you will see, and I'll speak about one aspect of this message, or how this message is conveyed. The reason being is that this site, the pyramids and the Sphinx, as we'll get into a minute, is intensely expressing astronomy. And even more mysteriously, especially the Great Pyramid, is expressing itself in mathematical terms. strange constants that we know today, like phi and pi, and other more powerful constants, like the E constants and various others that, by the way, tomorrow my brother will talk about this. If you're here tomorrow, it's worth listening, because this monument and the site is not behaving the way that Egyptologists are telling us it is. It is not fitting the model. It is not fitting the model that Egyptologists have conveyed about this site. Now, I'm very much into models these days because I'm writing a book with a theoretical physicist, Dr. Chandra Vikramasinghe, that I think Erik von Däniken spoke about yesterday, although I couldn't understand a word he was saying because I don't speak German. But I heard Chandra Vikramasinghe. He was talking about panspermia. I'm writing a book with Chandra, and I've been obliged to look into things like physics and various other aspects, and particularly quantum mechanics, but I want to get into this. But we understand the world, we understand everything, but particularly the world, with models. Physicists have created models, and then we learn a bit more, and we refine the model, or we change the model, if the theory does not fit what we're discovering. Well, what has been happening for the last 30 years or so, certainly since Robert Schock and West and various others, myself and Graham Hancock and all these researchers, is that the more we're understanding about the site, the more it doesn't respond to the model given by it. So let me show you the model, at least, that I'm beginning to see. Ah, there's another one. I like this one. It's a British passport. What has it to do? It's a bit like this Saudi Airlines. I guarantee you this. If ever you go to England or you go on holiday and you meet 10 British people and you ask them what is on your passport, they all carry the passport. They all travel and they carry it. And you ask them, you will find that maybe 8 out of 10 are very confused as to what is there. They will say, oh, wait a minute, I think maybe there is a unicorn. Yes, there is a unicorn. Yeah, and there is a lion. There's a lion here, yes. And but then you'll ask them what is written, what's written on it, and you'll find that maybe 1 out of 10 will say, well, there's something written, yes. Well, there is 2 sentences written here. And the strange thing is that they're not in English. They're actually in French. It's written in French. It's Dieu est mon droit and on y soit qui mal y pense. And then they all get, whoa, we're English. How come it's written in French? What is amazing is that there are millions and millions of British people carrying passports. It's a bit like this cross or the Saudi, and nobody bothers to look. It's one of the strange things. It's a funny thing. I remember a phrase, and Robert will know this, when John West said about the geology, he said, if you're looking for potatoes in a field full of diamonds, you're not going to see the diamonds. It's one of those strange things. So you get the idea. There are occasionally, whether it's by fluke, whether it's by chance, whether it's the way the brain works, they see something that others do not see. We all know, what has changed our whole way of thinking was people like Copernicus, who suddenly in his mind said, oh, I see the planets moving around the sun and not the other way around. Newton, the apple falls on his head. Apples have been falling on since the beginning of time. Not just apples, potatoes, bricks, arrows, rain. Many things have been falling. Nobody asked the question. Nobody said, why is it falling? And suddenly one guy, who happens to be the right guy, who happens to know a lot about mathematics, works it out. And the next thing we know, we're sending people to the moon, we're sending people to Mars, we're sending probes outside our solar system. This is how it works. But all these people who have come up with these breakthroughs, these advancements, face a huge, huge obstacle, which is the resistance of those who refuse to accept a change. This is historical. Whoop! Zahi Hawass, No, no, no. Please, please, no. No, 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 no. All right, here we get to the... Well, he said worse things about me, so it's okay, huh? Well, I'll do it like a story I did last time, and I'm going to move fast on here. In 1983, minding my own business, I was working as an engineer, you know, nothing to do with the pyramids or anything like that. And I took a trip to Egypt. I was born in Egypt. My mother was still living there. My brother, wake up, Paul. He knows the story. So. And my brother was living in Switzerland at the time. No, you were already in Spain. So. Anyway, cut long story short. I go there, I enter the museum. You know, I happen to have a camera with me. Those who know about cameras, in 1983 I had the OM-1 Olympus, remember this, no? And I look at the picture on the wall of the picture of the pyramids. And this is what I saw. Like the Mutawa priest. And I saw something that for some reason nobody, or had they seen it, they didn't ask the question. You know, three pyramids. And this one bothered me a lot. A small pyramid, smaller than the others, and offset. Offset. Just one of those things. I asked the question. I can imagine a lot of people seeing this picture or, you know, and think, but my question was, why is it small and why is it offset? Bang! Annoyed me. I'm going to move fast because I think that many of you know this very well, because I want to move to the Sphinx. Well, you're looking at a shot of the pyramid. It's actually a Google image. It's a square when you look at it from directly above. And it is directed, and my brother will argue about this tomorrow, but it is directed, each face faces one of the cardinal directions. Not magnetic directions, not magnetic north, this is astronomical north. It's very precise. Well, the east side, which is the most precise, is 3 arc minutes. It's about 5% of a single degree. It's extremely precise. And that alone should indicate to us that whoever designed this had astronomy in mind. He had this in mind. The scale of the monument, if you were to walk around it, it's kind of spooky. How many have been to Giza, to the pyramids? Oh, about a third of you. Well, no, you haven't been. Why do you raise your hand? Huh? You haven't been either. I'm playing a bit Hawass here. You don't know what you're talking about. Anyway, if you were to walk around the monument, you'd walk almost a kilometer. Each side is about 230 meters in length. It is frighteningly large. It is one of those monuments that... let me just tell you the feel of it, if you haven't been there. I've lived 3 years... Well, I used to go, I've been going there for 30 years. But I've lived actually 3 years in front of the pyramid. I had rented an apartment with my wife, and I had a balcony literally looking at the pyramid. And something very strange happens. You know, because I used to get out in the morning with a cup of coffee and look at the beautiful sunrise and the light on the pyramids and then sunset, and then in the morning at lunchtime, you know, I saw this pyramid all the time. And then one day I went out with my cup of coffee and I realized that, wait a minute, I'm not looking at the pyramid. I'm not looking at it anymore. And I looked down in the street and there's all these taxi drivers and all this chaos that goes around Cairo, if you've been there. And strange enough, nobody was looking at the pyramid. And realized it's psychological. You stop looking at it because it bothers you. It bothers you because you look at it and all these questions come into mind. Why is it there? Who put it there? When did they put it there? Why did they put it there? Who built it? How was it built? And you're bothered all day. And you don't want to get bothered at this all day, every day. So Egyptians don't look at it. They stop looking at it. It's one of those monuments that really, really bug you. It should not be there. It doesn't fit the context that we are told, built by people who had no machines, no nothing. It's so large, it's so perfect, and it's so anonymous. Nothing. Not a word in it. I was going to say cartouche, sorry, but you're right. All right. So, how do we explain this? Well, started looking at it more accurately. Oh, dear. This is a car that I had in 2005. I bought this car from an Egyptian. It's a Chrysler four-wheel drive. Never buy a car from an Egyptian, because when he sells it, it means it's no good. It blew up. It blew up. The minute I put the air conditioning, luckily I didn't put the air conditioning, it and caught fire. That's another story. What you're looking at here is pyramids following, according to Egyptologists, following the pyramid builders of Giza. In Giza, they are located to what they call the fourth dynasty. Give it a date of about 2500 BC, the whole complex. And these are pyramids that they tell us are from the fifth dynasty, about 150 years or so afterwards. Well, these, unlike the Giza pyramids, are filled with hieroglyphic texts. They're loaded with texts, plenty of texts. And here's a picture of one. It's the Pyramid of Unas. They're known as the pyramid texts. There's five royal pyramids that give texts, and you combine them together, and they're known as the pyramid texts. And you very quickly realize, when you read translations of these texts, they're on Google, on the internet now, you can get free copies and all this stuff, presumably in German, because, by the way, the Germans translated it first. Kurt Sette, his name is. The first translation of the pyramid texts were made by a German. Germans were very big in Egyptology, by the way, in those days. And you quickly realize that they speak about the sky. It's one thing you realize very quickly. And you can see the implications of the sky. There are stars drawn on the ceiling, lots of stars. And as you get more into them, you begin to realize that what they're trying to tell us is that something very strange, that when the king died, he goes to the stars. I mean, there's a lot, of course, metaphors and very difficult thing to understand, but the bottom line is, the king dies, he somehow gets converted into some spiritual entity, and they fly him off to the stars. That's what these texts say. And therefore, that's what, presumably, these monuments have to do with. I wish Eric von Däniken was here, because, well, if you place all this into a religious context, okay, Egyptologists said it's a religion, that's what they wanted to believe in. Nothing very different from other religions. You know. That's it. It's a religion, and that's what they're telling us. But maybe it isn't a religion. Maybe what they're telling us is true. Now, I don't know if it's possible to go to the stars with a pyramid. But I was telling a lady during lunch, so one thing you have to give to this place, because of the scale, because of the effort put in there, when you look at these monuments, particularly the Great Pyramid, that's it. You cannot allocate it a simplistic conclusion that these are tombs and they're built by crazy, superstitious people who believe that they were going to the stars. It doesn't fit the scale of the monument, and it doesn't fit its precision. And as you will see tomorrow, if you come and listen a bit to my brother and discussion we have, it doesn't fit what we're extracting from it. We're extracting some very complex mathematics from it. We're extracting an intelligence that is not supposed to be there. We're extracting iron that wasn't supposed to be there. Anyway, to cut a long story short, because I'm known for long stories, here are the pyramid texts, one passage, and it's very clear that what they tell us somehow is that the king somehow gets converted in what they call an Osirian figure. Osiris is the god of resurrection, according to the theology, and he becomes a star, and he joins a particular constellation in the sky, and this constellation is the constellation of Orion. So that's more or less what their mythology, their ideologies are telling us. And lo and behold, suddenly, and this was in 1964, an astronomer working with an Egyptologist, Virginia Trimble. She was an astronomer at Berkeley University, with an Egyptologist, Alexander Badawi, decided to investigate mysterious shafts that shoot out of the Great Pyramid. With Rudolf Gantenbrink, and so I'm not going to linger too much of how they were made, but what they found out as early as 1964 is that these shafts, the ones in the King's Chamber, pointed to Orion's belt. I came later in 86 and I worked out the alignments of the lower shafts. And the lower shafts of the Queen's Chamber, one of them pointed to the star Sirius, which fitted what the pyramid texts were telling us, except that this monument was speaking in a different language. It was speaking with astronomy. It's actually telling us the same thing, or more or less the same thing, with astronomy. I said, oh, a drop of water came down. You see it? Anyway. So, clearly, there is a relationship between these stars, the strange alignments, the setting out of the small pyramid, and it led me to look more carefully at this constellation. This is an actual photograph of the constellation. It's made up. You can see, by the way, you will be seeing this constellation till the end of May, and then it sets, and you don't see it till August next summer because of the cycles. But that's what you see in the sky. If you were to watch at Orion, you have to go rather late at night. Now, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, you can see it at this time of year. It's made up of four major stars, like a rectangle. In the middle is this so-called belt of Orion, or Orion's belt. And look at it more closely. Whoops, what happened here? What is it doing? Ah, yeah. Next to it, this is an actual picture as well. Here is the constellation, the star Sirius. This is the zone that pharaohs tell us they're going to go to after they die. It's a sort of cosmic world, if you like, or a star world. And next to it is the Milky Way, which in the text, in the pyramid text and other texts, they speak to of it as if it's a river. It looks like some sort of river in the sky. And they speak of it, they call it the winding waterway. It's as if they imagined a kind of picture, or a kind of map, or a kind of world that looked like their own, that had a river. Here I've exaggerated the design. I'm going to move a bit faster. So let's look a bit closer at this belt of Orion. And without much ado, there it is. It has the same configuration as the three pyramids on the ground. This became known as the Orion correlation theory. I published it in 1989, and like Robert, I thought I was going to please the Egyptologists, that we found something new, and they're going to be happy, and no. They hated me very badly to this day, particularly the ex-minister of antiquities, Dr. Hawass, and I've heard it all, from crazy to charlatan to pseudoscientist to Zionist to you name it. It's an ABC logic. We followed it carefully. But if that wasn't enough to upset them, we get to the Sphinx. We get to the Sphinx. And that really got them upset. There we are. I'm doing some projections here so you can see it nicely. This is an interesting one. I don't know if you can see it clearly. Here are the pyramids. They run on a southwest diagonal with a little one offset, and you see the Nile up there at the end. It's quite amazing when you superimpose the celestial image. It's kind of like two maps fitting each other. They're trying to tell us something, there is no doubt. There is some message here. And we can dispense with it. Even if they accept this, even if Egyptologists accept this, they will still say it is some superstitious message. They're telling us, you know, this is a sort of paradise and we want to make the cemetery. But maybe it isn't. It's too precise to be some crazy idea. All right, I published in 1989, I published my first article, nobody listened. Then I published a book called The Orion Mystery, and the BBC did a documentary, and that's when the Egyptologists got to hear about this. And, well, you were talking about the sky falling. The sky fell on my head, really. I mean, I did not expect this aggressive reaction. I really didn't. I was absolutely stunned by the way that the Egyptologists, archaeologists, particularly Egyptologists, were absolutely infuriated with this idea. I just couldn't get it. I still don't, but let me tell you one thing. They looked at it and they were saying, well, oh, you know, it's not possible, and they couldn't see the stars, they didn't have telescopes and all this stuff, and arguments went on and on and on, and the little star is a bit this way and the other one. All arbitrary, apart from the insults that followed, you know? Well, I can tell you one thing. No one bothered, because in science, we have scientists here, in science, when there is a theory, before you start knocking it down and insulting the people and calling them crazy and all this, if it is a theory that has substance, you know, I was talking about pyramid texts, I was talking about the alignment of the monuments, it was all fitting, it has substance. What you want to do is pass it through the correct tests, which are quantitative, statistical, qualitative, and see if you can falsify this theory. That's how it works. You know, you falsify it. And if you can't falsify it, then hard luck, the theory is good. The theory has to stand. Nobody bothered to do this until last year. Two Italian professors of astrophysics, who have no problem with this sort of stuff, took it on, and they did the tests. They did the tests, they passed it through the rigorous quantitative, statistical, qualitative, pages and pages of it, measurements, and they could not falsify it. They wanted to falsify it because that's what scholars wanted to do. They could not do it. And they had to admit that they could not do it, and they said, okay, we're going to be honest about this, we're going to publish it. We're going to publish it, and that's it. Well, when they send their paper around, when they send their paper around to be published, the paper kept being rejected, and they couldn't understand it. And they finally contacted me and said, we don't get it. We publish papers all the time about our astrophysics work, but this paper keeps getting rejected. And I said, where do you send it to? They said, we send it to archaeological magazines. I'm not surprised, because they send it to their peer reviewers, and their peer reviewers will not accept this, no matter what you say about this. But finally they got it published. I will show you the publication. And now Egyptologists, whether they like it or not, have to accept that this is a theory that has, you can't falsify it. You can't falsify it. And that is when an advancement is made. You have a theory that you can't falsify and you have to move forward. We have to start thinking in different terms here. Bah, voilà. The BBC did the program, that's how it got big. Now there is a problem, or seems to be a problem. Sure, you have three stars, look like the three pyramids, the texts tell you this, there's a shaft pointing, it all is nice. The only problem is this, is when you put it at the date of 2500 BC, the date that Egyptologists allocate to this site, the angle that the stars make when they are in alignment with the shaft, when they are in what we call the meridian, the middle of the sky, is very sharp. Very sharp. It's about 17 degrees to the horizontal, which is not like the pyramids. So that's what you get. Although you have a correlation, the stars, well, they should be like this. So, I remember I phoned my friend Graham Hancock and I said, I'm going to change this. He said, what are you going to do? He said, you can't move the pyramids. I hope you believe that you can't move the pyramids, right? Yes? Please, don't say yes. You can't move the pyramids. Hawass would be very upset if you move the pyramids. Although he would have liked to move the little ones to spoil the theory, right? And you can't move the stars. I mean, nobody's going to go up there and move the stars. Yes?
You can move the Earth.
You can move the Earth? Johan. You can move the stars, provided you are willing to consider another date. And that is where, this is the funny thing about science, is that you're so overpowered by the consensus of a date, this date of 2500 BC, 2500 BC, that you get blocked. You say, but people like me, who think a bit differently, say, okay, I'm going to try a different date. Try a different date. Now, here is the interesting thing, because I think you're looking at your watch.
Yes.
How much? No, I have another half hour, no? The date. Where am I? the date that I wanted to look at wasn't just an arbitrary date. I'm going to say, let's try various dates and see what fits. The Egyptians speak in their text, in the pyramid text and other texts that we will talk later, I think David will talk about it as well, is the Edfu text. But basically, all these texts say that there was what they call the beginning, the first time. What they have this strange term. In ancient Egyptian, it was zeptepi. It literally means the first time. The first time when, in their mind, or maybe in reality, things began, the civilization began, the whole activity of the civilization began. So I said, okay, first time. I know that the stars move in precessional cycles. Precession is a cycle where the Earth, by the way, moves, you're right, absolutely right, the Earth moves. We all know that the Earth moves in a rotation of 24 hours. You know, we get the effect of night and day and all this business. The Earth goes around the sun and we get the effects of the season. Right? But the Earth has a little wobble. It wobbles, but very slowly, 26,000 years, and this is known as the precession. And the effect you have is the stars appear to wobble, but in fact it's us who are wobbling. And the result is that the stars that you're observing, if you could observe them through that period, which you can, by the way, with computers now, you can speed up 26,000 years in 3 minutes if you want, or 1 minute, you will see them going up and down at the meridian, up and down, in a cycle of 26,000 years, but you will see them also turn. So I thought, let's go to the lower point, the beginning of one cycle, which maybe the Egyptians called the first time, the beginning. And lo and behold, here is the, we'll skip that, here is the cycle that would happen, moving up and down, 13,000 years, 13,000 years up, 26,000 years in total. Up, down, up, down, up, down, forever. As long as this planet does the same thing. But the low point, the beginning, gave the date of 10,500 BC. And that ding clicked in my mind, because we kept hearing this 10,500 BC. As you can see, Robert is arriving at that date with the geology as well. Something happened there, there's no doubt. It seems as if they're trying to tell us, with their strange language of astronomy and mathematics, as we see, there's something going on here, and it's something to do with this date. When you bring it down to this date, when you zip the stars down in precession, something else happens. The Milky Way also turns and fits itself with the Nile. You're getting a correlation. You're getting something that locks, like a bit like a coffre fort, like a safe. You turn it, you turn the sky, and it locks on the land. It locks in the image. You did this for me, David, huh? And this is an actual proper image with Google. You can do three-dimensional. Here is the Nile shooting off with the Milky Way, and it fits. It fits. And it fits at the date of 10,500 BC. But here is the weird thing. Here is the weird thing. When these stars are on meridian, this meridian line, they fit with the axis of the pyramid. At that date, and at that date only, they are there at the moment of the spring equinox. Now, if you know some very basic astronomy, It is at the spring equinox that the sun would rise due east, exactly east, exactly east. And that immediately attracts attention to another direction with another monument that is looking due east on that site, and that is the Sphinx. The Sphinx, there we are, let's move. Here, by the way, are the published articles. You can get them on Google, there. This is the articles by the two Italians who could not falsify the theory. I'll skip on that. There's the image that drove Hawass crazy, if you've seen the And we move to the Sphinx. Move to the Sphinx. There it is. You can see the scale of it. This is one of our guests on the tour. That's a woman. But I looked a bit like this when I was younger. Unless you meant the Sphinx. All right. I want to move very quickly here, but there's something very interesting, because the pyramid texts give a name to the various objects in the sky. So they say Orion is Osiris and so forth. The Egyptologists have stuck on a name about the Sphinx, which comes from a much later period, the New Kingdom, and that name is Horem Achet. It means Horus of the Horus in the horizon. Sorry, Horus in the horizon. Now, what they won't accept, which the pyramid texts insist on, and many other texts of the New Kingdom, in fact, when they excavated around the Sphinx, they found many little plaques, votive messages, people putting messages to the Sphinx, calling him by another name, which is very similar, Horus in the horizon. So we have Horus of the horizon, Horus in the horizon. The pyramid texts are full of messages talking about Horus, this Horus in the horizon, Horem Horakti, they call it Horakti, is that right? Yeah, the twin. Now, and yet Egyptologists say the pyramid texts, in fact, no text, no writing of the ancient Egyptians speak about the Sphinx before the New Kingdom, which is 1,000 years after the building, supposedly the building of the pyramids. How is it possible? How is it possible that a monument like this, standing there for thousands of years, and there is not one single word about it in the Egyptian text, except in the New Kingdom, 1,000 years later? It's not possible. And how is it possible that the pyramid texts do not speak about the Sphinx? Well, they do, but they speak about the Sphinx in a cosmic manner. They call him Horus in the horizon, Horakti, or the twin horizon, and here is passages, and they even tell us where it is. They say that the king represents the sun. I'll skip on this, and they tell us that a journey is taking place in the sky. There's some activity going in the sky, and the king is going to take a journey. I'm going to move here. Here it is. Here it is. Look very carefully here. They tell us that the sun, or the king, the solar king, reaches the banks of the celestial river. He's there, and he's waiting to cross the river. The texts are full of these messages. And he tells the messages, cross the river, cross the Nile, and go to a figure they called Horus in the horizon. And they even suggest, we can work this out from the pyramid texts and other rituals, that it takes 70 days to go there. We know that the period of invisibility of the stars that create this magical ritual is 70 days. We know that the mummification period was 70 days. And when you move the sun across here to 70 days, lo and behold, it reaches the constellation of Leo. It reaches what they call Horakti. There is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that this figure in the sky is Leo. But they give the same name to the Sphinx. They give the same name to the Sphinx. There is a correlation here, there's no doubt. Well, there you are. 70 days later, the sun has crossed the river and gone to this place. So we know now what they imagine somehow to be a Sphinx in the sky. But, let's see if I have it here. To even emphasize the time when this is supposed to happen, there is a plaque, there is a stela on the Sphinx. And this stela says, it's known as the dream stela, I'm not going to bother about the whole story of how the pharaoh removed the sand, has a statement. It calls the place where there is the Sphinx the first time. This Tep Zepi, this date that's coming out. It's actually written there by a pharaoh who should have known about his own history. Egyptologists totally discount this. They give us the time. Provided you can work it out, understanding the astronomy of the place. The Sphinx at night, by the way, lit up. So, we look. They tell us, look at the sun rising at spring equinox. So we look at the sun. Let's look at the sun on spring equinox. Well, if you look at it today, here is it. It will happen, by the way, it's already happened on the 22nd of March, right? Spring equinox. How do you say it in German? Gach Nacht. Okay. The spring equinox, 22nd of March. So if you go on the 22nd of March and you look at the sky, you see the sun rising due east. Then it moves depending on, it will move towards summer. It's going to move now towards the north and reach summer solstice. But now at spring equinox, it's in the middle. And if you were able to see the stars behind the sun at spring equinox, you would see the constellation of Aquarius. Now, who is more than 60 years old, like me? Just one. Come on, don't lie. You're more than 60 years old, my brother. If you're my age, you would remember the time of the hippies. You remember the flower power, and we always, the age of Aquarius, you know. Well, they didn't know what it meant, but actually what it meant is we're entering a new zodiacal period, which is Aquarius. Because of the precession of the equinoxes, these constellations, which we call the zodiacal constellation, they move every 2,000 years or so, 2,160 years to be precise, moves one block. So we're now in the age of Aquarius. Well, let's go back in time. So we look at the time of, well, around the time of Jesus, and it's a constellation of Pisces. And if you are from the Greek Orthodox or the Coptic Church in Egypt, you would understand why they have Pisces, because the iconography at the time was the fish. They represent Jesus with a fish, which explains, more or less, that they followed the zodiacal. Well, we go to the time of the pyramids, and whoops, that's 2,000, we're supposed time of the pyramids, and you get Aries, and it doesn't look like Aries at all. Aries is supposed to be a lamb. It doesn't look like the Sphinx, certainly. We go back in time to 8,000 BC, and you get Cancer, and you go back in time to that date. And not surprisingly, you get the age of Leo. We have now two sets of monuments on the same site, one looking east at an image that represents himself, and we have the pyramids looking south with a correlation of the Belt of Orion. To have this statistically being a coincidence is, well, don't bother to work it out. It's something like one in a million. It cannot be a coincidence. I've had statisticians look at it. I've had people trying to falsify. It cannot be a coincidence. It's too much. We have three factors. Leo with the Sphinx, the pyramids with Orion's belt, and the Nile with the Milky Way. So, do we just brush this aside and say, well, you know, like Egyptology, or is there something here? Are they trying to say something? Are they build this as some sort of message to us or to anybody who will bother to try and decipher it? Here is the complex. And here is the famous picture that caused one hell of a problem last year when it was shown to Zaha was. I don't know why he went crazy, but he saw my face and just almost ended up in a psychological hospital after that. Have you seen this video? He goes completely mad. Never mind. Right. Three pyramids, three stars, the Milky Way, and belt, and Leo. Okay, fine. What does it mean? What are they saying? Okay, a date. Okay, we got a date. Possible date. Geology seems to come up with the same conclusion. We have to consider that date. I cannot prove it. I can show it with astronomy, but it's not physical. It's an astronomical theory, and therefore I cannot say that this date is a real date. Maybe they're memorializing. Maybe they're expressing their ideas like we express with the church. You know, we build a church and we say it belongs to the time of Jesus. You know, the idea of the church. Either or. But geology is physical, and geology is suggesting that this date is real. Maybe the monuments, at least not the pyramids, but perhaps the Sphinx is of that date or some other aspects of that Sphinx. But whatever it is, they're giving us a date. But they're giving us something else. And Robert mentioned it very briefly. Look where the sun is. It's just below the Sphinx. The whole thing seems to be designed in such a way that you finally conclude that there is a map in the sky, some sort of map that represents what's on the ground, and you're supposed to correlate this. And the focus is the position of the sun due east at the time of the spring equinox. It happens to be below this line in the sky. Well, are they telling us there's something below the Sphinx? Geology shows it. I don't want to get into Edgar Cayce, but yes, it's been mentioned in a psychic way that there is something under this monument. Seems to be. I am going to. There. Okay, yeah. If you were going to look at the Sphinx alone, forget the pyramids. You have the Sphinx. You have its two temples, which were discussed by Robert. And you have this temple here, which is linked up with the causeway. There seems to be a complex that is detached from the pyramid, and yet it is part of the scheme, that is much, much older. Because it isn't just the Sphinx that looks very old, as Robert pointed out. It is the erosion on these monuments. It doesn't take a rocket engineer when you go to Giza to realize that you're looking at things that look much more eroded, older than when you're looking at the pyramids. The erosion is very deep, and the construction is different. They're using megalithic blocks, some weighing about 100 tons, on average 50 tons. Not at all the way they build the pyramids. The pyramids, are, although very big, they're built with blocks on average about 2 tons. That's big enough, but 50 tons, 100 tons, is a completely different kind of construction. We're looking seemingly as another period, an older period, that designed a complex. Because it is so focused on the position of the rising sun on a specific day, it must be some sort of solar complex. It must be indicated. And indeed, the Sphinx is named Horus of the Horizon, which we know in their iconography is a solar god. They represent him as a sun god. And because the sun reaches this constellation at that time where they want to indicate us, it is mixed with a solar idea. There's no doubt that it is a solar complex. But if you have a solar complex alone, the sun will always rise due east in front of the Sphinx, always. This year, next year, for 1,000 years from now, 10,000 years from now. You cannot tell the date. You cannot tell the date. All you can tell is that it is pointing at the sun on the spring equinox. You can tell the date if you see the stars behind it, or if you link it to stars that are attached to the idea, and that's what they've done. When you have stars and the solar system, then we can work out the date, because the stars change with precession. It is an ingenious complex, it is an ingenious design, if this is true. And nothing can be 100%, but to me, I'm convinced 99.9% that we're talking about something that is generally there. That is a huge, huge question. Because it's giving us a date. It's luring our attention to this strange and very difficult, almost superhuman construction. It is provoking us to ask questions because it's anonymous. It's inviting us to say, who put it there, why put it there, when put it there? And we can't ignore this because it's pushing us to do this. And it's pushing us, I'll show you a link very quickly and you will expand it in 5 minutes. There are very, very mysterious texts. If you go to the temple of Horus at Edfu, the temple is literally a book in stone. It's filled with inscriptions. It took 23 years to copy these inscriptions on paper, and even more years to translate them all. Some are not even translated, so many of these inscriptions. The main theme of these inscriptions is to invite us to consider the origins of their civilization. They call this first time again. It's references this first time, the beginning, and this, they even describe what happened in mythological terms. But amazingly, they give us a date. Not the 10,000, we were this astronomy. They give us a date in the year. They tell us that something happened that finally created the first pharaoh of Egypt, the first Horus, king of Egypt. And that date involves a great battle where this man, whoever he was, this Horus, conquered an enemy called Set and became king. He ruled, he became the king of all of Egypt. And they give us the date of the year. They give us a date in their calendar, and they give us the date of the first of the fifth month of their calendar. We know that their calendar began at the summer solstice. The summer solstice, which today we call the 21st of June. So we can work out from their calendar when was that first day of the first month, which is 120 days, by the way, don't work it out. It's 120 days, to be precise, 121 days after the summer solstice. So you move the sun is at summer solstice, you move it 121 days, and you reach a position, and that's where the sun will be every year. Every year, there. On that first day of the fifth month of the Egyptian calendar. And not surprisingly, it aligns with the causeway. You will see this more accurately. You have a drawing of it. It's too much. It's too much. They're commemorating an event that they explain to us is their beginning. It has something to do with a most mysterious origin. It may have something to do with what happened in 10,500 BC. And they're inviting us with this site to decipher it and to ignore it, to call it a tomb, to call it superstition is a grave mistake. It's a grave mistake. I'm going to leave the continuation to David Roll. Thank you very much. That's where I stop. Thank you.